You may proceed.
Good morning. I'm James Kurz on behalf of the appellant. I reserve 5 minutes for my rebuttal. This case presents this court with what I call a trifecta opportunity. You may correct the error of the circuit court in refusing to go forward with the trial on remand. You may develop a law of successor liability in Virginia. And you may significantly move this case, which is now in its seventh year, towards resolution. I begin with the last point. At the core of this case, very clearly, is the issue of bona fide transactions. We have detailed in our brief seven steps that were followed by the judgment debtors and their attorneys to evade the judgment of the court, the 2012 judgment. That judgment was for $370,000. To this point, the defendants have paid less than one half of 1% of that judgment. It now stands at $540,000. We were able to track through tax returns over $1.2 million moving through various accounts. So to some degree, the evasion methods were successful. But if these evasion techniques are allowed to stand and they are not, or they are deemed to be bona fide transactions, then I submit to this court that the law of successor liability and fraudulent conveyance in this commonwealth has been rendered toothless. I said there were three things that we were addressing. The first one would be the circuit court's refusal to try the case. When the case came back from this court after the appeal in 2017, there were two counts remaining: fraudulent conveyance and successor liability. We had tried the successor liability case once before. You reversed and remanded on the fraudulent conveyance. You had also reversed the circuit court, which had granted summary judgment on that. We came back. We were headed for a trial on both issues. The last hearing before the scheduled trial, which was to be before an advisory jury, the judge granted judgment for the defendants and said, I find that the conduct was a bona fide transaction.
But I thought there was a non-suit of the fraudulent conveyance.
There is a non-suit. Well, what happens is we come up to the trial. We are trying both counts. We are scheduled to try both counts. When Judge Rockwell says, I grant the defendant's motion for judgment on the successor liability claim, he then goes on to say, and I find that these transactions in the aggregate are bona fide. What we do at that point, first, we come back. We ask for reconsideration.
Can we stop just right there? I thought you were saying that the court had given the defendants a judgment on the fraudulent conveyance claim, and my understanding is that it did not, that you had non-suited that claim.
It did not. And that's why, rather than try these cases piecemeal, at that point, we came back, we sought reconsideration. We argued the NASA versus Board of Supervisors case and saying when this case remands without specific instructions, the default position is that we start anew with the slate wiped clean.
But our later cases, and the Court of Appeals has clarified that the full retrial on remand is when the appellee has some other issue to raise, usually, I have another reason why I could win. There's a new issue. And in this case, notwithstanding your second point, of which is the judge is just plain wrong, there is a preponderance of successor liability. Was there really any necessity to rehear the case, rehear the same witnesses a bench trial? So, I mean, is there any reason to have gone through that process?
I can say that we probably would have tried the case differently. But the key claim here really was the fraudulent conveyance. That would be the money claim. Successor liability, in this instance, would transfer the liability from what had been bonded.
As Justice Goodwin's pointed out, I mean, the fraudulent conveyance variable doesn't play a role anymore. Your main argument appears to me to be the last one, which is, let's end this case. No reasonable fact finder could not find preponderance given these facts and enter judgment. Isn't that your main argument?
Yes, sir. I think that's the case.
How can we say that? I'm not suggesting we can't. I'm just asking you to try to persuade us that we should look the fact finder in the eye and say, you know what, I'm sorry, but that's just plain unreasonable to come out the other way.
There are two ways. When this case comes back, and assuming that NASIF does apply, then the prior ruling has been vacated. At that point, I believe when this court looks at the facts, it's applying a preponderance of the evidence standard. If that is not the case, then we're applying 801-680, which is the standard plainly wrong. In this case, when we look at all of these facts, and you told us in the opinion in the LaBelladonna 1 case that in the aggregate it supported an inference that it was not a bona fide transaction.
Well, technically, we said it was a permissible inference. We obviously weren't making fact-finding on appeal.
That's correct.
The question is, could a rational fact-finder look at this record, particularly given our earlier review of the record, and come out thinking there's no preponderance of the absence of successor liability?
I think that is exactly the case. There are two parts within that seven-step progression. One of them is with the two most valuable assets of Bonaire Med Spa, which were the client list and the advanced bookings. Those transferred literally overnight on October 17th from Bonaire to Bella Femme, such that in the morning of the 18th, Bella Femme was in business with those assets. We've identified in the brief, I think at page 13, a chart showing that Bella Femme is a clone of Bonaire. But when you look at those two assets, again, they were the most valuable assets, and they paid absolutely nothing for them. Now, what we have in the most recent brief, which we did not have before, is an allegation by the appellees that these briefs, that these assets were now included under a monthly lease arrangement. I submit to this court that is a complete fiction. When we were here before, they had a different explanation. They said, well, the client list was loaded on the computers, and therefore, when the computers were sold, it was the client list transferred. Now they've said monthly lease. They had an argument for monthly lease for some of the assets before, but that was unsupported in the documents. In fact, it was contradicted in the documents. The general ledger of Bonaire and then moving over to Bella Femme showed that the payments being received were attorney fee payments. And indeed, Bonaire had been paying monthly payments on its fees owed to Ayers and Stolte. But we were told at that time, well, you know, the general ledger software, QuickBooks, did not have a provision for lease arrangements, and therefore we had to include it as an attorney fee. Well, that simply was untrue, because we pointed out in the record that there are other general ledger entries for lease payments. And QuickBooks is a widely used, respected general ledger software. It has the capability. This time they've come back and they said, well, we have the client list and the advanced bookings, and they too are under the monthly lease. But that is also a complete fiction. That is the kindest word I can say. The truth is that there was a listing that the defendants had of the assets that they were transferring, they were going to sell at auction. And that list does not include client list or advanced bookings. And then we can
of
go
course,
straight
to... Of course, their argument is they were on the computer and the computer was listed.
Well, that was their argument last time. But even then, the client list and the advanced bookings were not on any sort of a list. What they were saying was that the computer contained an Excel spreadsheet that listed had the client listings. So they were saying, well, we obviously transferred, when we sold the computer, we sold the listings. First, it was never established that, in fact, it was there, but it seemed it would be an extraordinary situation to transfer an asset worth probably $100,000 to $125,000 on a used computer for $200. The second thing that I point out as to why it is a fiction is we looked at the testimony of Betty Boyd, who was the managing member of both Bonaire and Bella Femme, and who did all of the accounting. And when she was asked whether they paid for the advanced bookings and client list, she said, no, we didn't. Never paid. That alone should be enough to say this is not a bona fide transaction.
Acquiring the assets of a departing entity at no value through a straw purchaser.
Yes. The second point that I would rely on.
You're down in 5 minutes. You can use your time any way you want.
The second argument has to go with the role of Ayers and Stolte. Ayers and Stolte, they were the trial attorneys. They were the attorneys, moving through into the start of the second case. And they also involved, they were the ones who designed and orchestrated this scheme. You know, it set out in the facts that 2 days before the Belladonna could collect or execute on the judgment, Ayers and Stolte was at Bonair, and they then formed Bellafin, a new entity, exact clone with a single difference that the ownership wasn't the prior three members. It was their two husbands and an adult son who paid an aggregate of $500. Two of them paid absolutely nothing. Excuse me?
Adult son. Oh, okay.
Yes.
I thought you said adult.
Then we progressed on. But it was Ayers and Stolte that orchestrated this. Bellafin was formed. Ayers and Stolte is the registered agent. The office for the entity is identified as the Ayers and Stolte offices. Then we go through, when we get to the auction, Ayers and Stolte is there representing both sides. When there is a sale, Ayers and Stolte prepares the documents. We pointed out that, a small point, that they claimed that the transaction closes in December. The documents, we were able to eventually determine, were not even created until March. They backdated the documents.
So they did the foreclosure and they bought at their own auction.
They did the foreclosure, they bought at their own auction. When two of the individual defendants filed for bankruptcy, and the bankruptcy court eventually said, no, you don't get out, these are non-dischargeable debts, Ayers and Stolte represented the defendants, these same two defendants. The $85,000 note that Ayers and Stolte says is the touchstone for their defense, neither one of those defendants, or those bankruptees, even identified the $85,000 debt on their bankruptcy filings. Ayers and Stolte prepared those. Their explanation was, well, we orally waived them. Well, that's directly contrary to the language of the note. Ayers and Stolte never should have been involved in this transaction. Not only the other multiple conflicts, but Charles Ayers, who was the managing member at the time, was under a Virginia State Bar order from 2001 not to do business with his clients, and the law firm was concluded in that order. What Ayers did here was a direct violation of that order, and worse yet, Ayers was subsequently disbarred. Their involvement by itself, I would say, would take this case out of the realm of a bona fide transaction, making it a tainted transaction. For a number of reasons, this court, I believe, can move straight to that point and determine and make a finding that those transactions were not bona fide. We could come back on the successor liability. I would ask you to enter judgment for the successor liability, on the successor liability claim. And then going forward, that there would be a collateral estoppel effect, I believe, on the fraudulent conveyance, which you were right, rather than try the case piecemeal. I say try the case. We were told very clearly by the circuit court judge, his words still ring in my ears, Mr. Kurz, I'm not trying this case again. And at that point, I still had the major claim outstanding and reversed from this court. So no further questions. I'll refer to the opposition and respond in rebuttal.
You have 1 minute and 4 seconds left.
Excuse me?
You have 1 minute and 4 seconds left.
May I add that to my rebuttal time?
Did you say you wanted to add it to your rebuttal time? No, I just want to make sure that you don't misunderstand this. You have 1 minute and 4 seconds of rebuttal time.
I'll use my time left.
Okay.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Joe Blackburn. I represent Ayers and Stolte and Charles Ayers in this matter. I have the privilege of taking the first 5 minutes, and I was going to address assignment of error number one. And Mr. Tyree, who represents Bellafin and was involved in the underlying trial, was going to address the sufficiency of the evidence issues raised in assignment of error number two. And this case involves, the appeal here involves a claim for successor liability that was reversed and remanded by the, solely because the trial court applied the wrong standard of care. And it was there was no issue about what evidence was presented. There was no issue that evidence was improperly struck or improperly admitted. It was solely that the trial court should have applied a preponderance standard to the mere continuation theory instead of the clear and convincing standard. So this court sent it back to apply that standard. A new trial date was set. Additional discovery was allowed. No new evidence came forward on liability for the successor liability claim. There was a hearing, and there was a motion to have the court decide the issue based on the underlying trial record. And that's what happened. And I think it was exactly what the court's mandate was, which was accordingly, we affirm the judgment of the circuit court in part, reverse in part, and remand for further proceedings consistent with this opinion. And that's exactly what the court did. It went back, it considered all the evidence was already in there. There was no new evidence to consider, and it reached its decision, finding that on a preponderance standard, they still had not proven successor liability.
Why isn't that decision wrong?
Why isn't which decision?
Now that he's got the right standard and the evidence is intact, tell me why your opponents are not correct when they say that the trial judge erred at that point by finding the evidence insufficient.
Well, I think the evidence at trial, the underlying trial, established that this was, in fact, a bona fide transaction. My opponent likes to throw stones at the Ayers firm, but what they did here, they represented the client, and on the eve of trial, they hadn't been paid. They entered a note. There are admissions in the record that it was a valid note. There was a security agreement that secured the fees. There was a judge
identified on the bankruptcy petition as an asset?
Not of the individuals.
Well, who was the note from?
The note was between Bon Air and the individuals, and at the time the individuals didn't have any funds to go after, and the law firm was in a position that the only assets out there for them to collect their fees or for Mr. Kurz to collect on his judgment was the secured assets of Bon Air, which were sold at auction for $10,000. The Ayers testified that he instructed his firm to make an opening bid of $10,000, and that's it. They would have loved for the other MedSpa to come in and pay more for it. And they went in and they offered $10,000 at a publicly noticed, properly executed auction, and nobody else bid. The plaintiff's president was at that auction.
Were any of the documents backdated?
They weren't backdated. They were dated to the time that the transaction occurred. So there was a bill of sale. After Ayers bought the equipment at the auction, months later, 3 months later, they leased it back to them. There was a bill of sale back in March. They dated that to December, and they applied the lease payments, and it's written in the bill of sale of $1,000 a month. So it was a $40,000 sale, but the lease payments brought it down to $35,000 because they credited those payments in the bill of sale. They also had a note, and they dated it all because they, using the lease payments, that was the date of the transaction. The note itself has a notarized signing on it when it was signed. There was no attempt to hide. This is all before any litigation is involved. They were properly laying out the transaction. They didn't forge a notary. It says on the date when the note was signed. There was no attempt to hide when this transaction occurred.
Well, the note, to me, the $85,000 note, what was that for? Was that supposed to be the amount of the attorney's fees?
There was about $70,000 in attorney's fees unpaid before going into the week-long trial and the trade secrets litigation before any of this started, and it was to secure those and fees that were assumed to be incurred through trial and post-trial briefing. So it was signed right before trial to cover the unpaid fees and the fees that would be incurred through trial.
So there was no cash to change hands?
That was just between, I think they had paid a little bit of the fees, but there was an outstanding balance of close to $70,000 at that time.
Was the client list an asset, counsel?
Excuse me?
Was the client list an asset?
I think the client list travels with the aestheticians. The assets in that business are the aestheticians providing the service. And you can't take a client list. The client list was worthless to Ayers and Stolte. They couldn't do anything with it. They needed aestheticians.
Would the client list have been of value to Bellefemme?
To Bellefemme. If they had the aestheticians that can provide the services to those clients who choose specifically to go to that aesthetician. It's a personal business, and like the advanced bookings...
So there would be some value to the list.
If the clients stay with... If it transfers to somebody who stays with... If the clients stay with that aesthetician...
So why would that asset be hidden within the computer? What is the argument that the list was in the computer?
The situation was, it's a law firm that has foreclosed on all the assets. They don't have any way to monetize these assets. They foreclose on it, and they're selling it all. They list on the foreclosure.
But their argument is, as I understand it, had the list been separately listed as an asset, we would have bid because that was of value to us. But we had no interest in the $200 used Dell computer.
And that's their argument. They also made no questions at the auction. They could have spoken with Mr. Worrell, who ran the auction, and found out. They made no question, and that was an argument that's been raised after the fact. This was a situation of a law firm who was foreclosed on assets of a med spa, can't do anything with it, and was selling them all.
But let me ask you this. The thing that I thought was a little bit odd, the law firm has a note for $85,000 that they've gotten from their clients, right?
Correct.
And they foreclose, and they go through all this, foreclosure, and then they take a lesser note from the same people as a result of the foreclosure. I mean, why would you go through all of that just to get a note for half of what you already had a note for?
They hadn't got paid on anything, and they had no use of this spa equipment. La Bella Donna wouldn't buy it for over $10,000, and they were just trying to make use of it the best they could. Obviously, I've gone over my time.
Your time has expired. Rebuttal? Are you?
I think that's fine.
You have, all right, go right ahead.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Ben Tyree. I represent Bellefemme Enterprises, LLC, and the remaining MedSpa defendants. As Mr. Blackburn stated, my intention is to focus specifically on assignment of error number two in this appeal, which has to do with the bona fide finding of the trial court as it regards to the transactions under scrutiny in this case.
If you assume, for the sake of argument, that in a small service sector, closely held company, that the client list is probably, in most cases, the most important asset of the business. Didn't that asset get transferred through a straw purchaser to the successor firm at no value, essentially?
No, I totally disagree with that statement, Your Honor. And this asset...
Which part?
I'm sorry?
Which part? That the list had value or it was transferred?
Well, I agree that
no
the list
value.
Had value to a limited market, such as another med spa, and I would agree that it has value to Bellefemme, which was the purchasing entity.
Did they pay for that asset?
I'm sorry?
Did they pay for that asset?
Absolutely they did, and they paid for it originally as part of the lease, and then in March 2013 they paid for it with the note and the payments made on that note. The client list and the appointment list are two of a bevy of assets. And
they purchased the client asset list, the client list asset, through the lease. Tell me how that works.
They leased all assets that were foreclosed upon by Ayers and Stolte. So the note that was signed and the financing statement that was filed perfecting the security interest in that note included all assets of Bonaire Med Spa, and it listed specifically all general intangibles. There was no exclusion for any asset. To need to specify that the client list as one particular asset or the appointment list for one particular asset, it doesn't follow similarly to how there wasn't a list of specific inventory items. It said inventory. It didn't list specific bottles of wax or oils and things like that. The
client list was far more valuable than a used Dell computer.
Well, the client list's value is, I would argue, Your Honor, that the value of the client list has almost no value on the open market.
That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about the very players in the very list of clients. There's nothing more valuable in the service sector than that.
I understand your point, and it's well taken. However, it was included. The trial testimony made clear that the client list all assets of Bonnier Med Spa were foreclosed upon by Ayers and Stolte. The part of your initial question I disagree with is that Ayers and Stolte was not a straw purchaser. That Ayers and Stolte was a creditor of Bonnier Med Spa, admitted as such by La Belladonna, did not get paid as agreed, foreclosed, and at that point, Ayers and Stolte took title, which was later perfected through a public auction when it purchased those, took title to all the assets.
Including the list.
Absolutely. Yeah, there were no exceptions, no exclusions. The note and the financing statement that Ayers and Stolte received from Bonnier in March 2012 before the original trial made no exclusions. It said all the assets of Bonnier Med Spa, including all general intangibles, and the client list and the appointment list would fall under that umbrella of
If you were trying to maximize the bid at auction, wouldn't it be reasonable to list the client list as a separate asset, the most valuable asset of this business? If I'm trying to get more than my bid of $10,000 from perhaps La Belladonna, wouldn't I list the client list, counsel, if this is truly an arm's length transaction?
Perhaps, Your Honor, and I'm not in a position to go back
and... perhaps? Why wouldn't one?
Well, Judge, I think the true value, again, for a potential auction purchaser, doesn't lie in the client list. The client list for a service-based business such as this one is a list of names. And the estheticians, the actual people who are providing the services to the clients, their relationship with those clients would likely follow. So if someone not related were looking at the auction notice and deciding whether or not to bid on this to bid on the assets being sold,
they would want a $200 used computer, but they wouldn't want a client list in this exact industry.
Well, a client list is only valuable, my argument would be that it's only valuable.
You don't have a business with clients.
Correct, but it's not a situation where you have ongoing contracts with folks, where they're going to be under agreement or under a lease or where you're selling widgets. This is a service-based business.
It's a situation where someone has already been shown to want beauty products and services, to purchase beauty products and services within that very small neighborhood, and where they have the money to do so and probably the continued desire to do so. That sounds like a pretty valuable asset.
I understand that. And those people who have identified themselves as being those interested in those services have already chosen specific estheticians at Bonnier Med Spa to provide those services. It's, again, as we stated in our brief, it's a very personal sort of service that's received. Testimony at trial, which is unrebutted, is that the clients follow the estheticians. They go with who they like, I believe, is a paraphrase of the testimony at trial. The judge heard that testimony. The trial court heard the same arguments that Mr. Kurz is bringing now and found those arguments unpersuasive. The client list and the list of upcoming appointments, that's not a new issue on this appeal. That was heard by the trial court, and ultimately the trial court found it unpersuasive, along with a bevy of other evidence that weighs in favor of finding a bona fide transaction here. Ayers and Stolte's witness testified unrebutted that his only interest in any of these transactions was to get paid for the attorney's fees that they had outstanding. Bell Femme's witness testified that his only interest was in running a profitable business and doing so as profitably and as well as he could. We can't overlook also the Rule 411 admissions that the plaintiff presented in this case. They admitted, and I'll run through this list quickly because I know they're in the briefs as well. They admitted that Bonnier Med Spa was indebted to Ayers and Stolte at the time of the note, and that goes to the good valid consideration. They admitted that Bonnier Med Spa granted a security interest in all of its assets to Ayers and Stolte, and that's important. It goes back to what we were discussing just now. It granted a security interest in all the assets, not all the assets except a client list, in all of the assets, and that's conclusively established.
It seems more relevant fraudulent conveyance than successful liability.
Well, it goes to the bona fide nature of this claim, which is an element of both fraudulent conveyance, which is not before this court now, and also goes to successor liability. A bona fide finding in a successor liability claim is a threshold determination. And if the court determines that a transaction was bona fide, then there is no need to go to the comparison table of the similarities between the businesses.
But when a successor corporation inherits a considerable asset with essentially no identification of the asset in any of the process or valuation of the asset, isn't that a key fact, while, albeit not in fraudulent conveyance law, but in successor liability law?
That it received it without identification? Do I understand your question?
That basically the client list made itself to the parties without ever being identified, valued, specifically bid upon, or even addressed. It's all being cloaked by some very broad terms like intangible assets. And, of course, it is an intangible asset.
Your Honor, I believe that this argument that the client list wasn't included was something that La Belladonna concocted after the fact as part of this current litigation. As Mr. Blackburn pointed out, the notice, the auction notice which La Belladonna received specifically said, if there's any questions, ask Mr. Worrell, who conducted the auction. They didn't do that. They certainly could have. If there was any doubt in their mind whether the auction, or excuse me, whether the client list and the asset were part of the assets, they could have made that inquiry, and they didn't do that. That argument is one that, in my opinion, was made up as part of this litigation after the fact to justify not bidding on the auction assets.
One last question. Did La Belladonna Skincare, Inc. ever make any payments to the law firm after the transfer, either direct or indirect?
Well, La Belladonna is the plaintiff.
Right.
He means Belfem.
Did Belfem? After the purchase?
Right.
Yes, they did. They paid.
Belfem Enterprises, LLC.
Yes. Your Honor, they did. They were current, I believe, until this litigation was started, and that's been suspended to pay for their defense here. But up until that point, from the time that the note was entered until this litigation was filed, I do believe they were current on their payments.
So it's in the law firm's interest for them to continue to operate at some margin of profit in order to pay their own fees?
Absolutely. And as a self-interested creditor, Ayers and Stolte here, in short, found itself in a very compromised position. It had $80,000-plus dollars in attorney's fees that remained unpaid. They understood, as any self-interested creditor would, that the true value of these assets were not in the bottle of oil or the jar of wax, but in that ongoing relationship between the estheticians and their clients. How do they maximize that value is to transfer those assets or sell those assets for value to an entity that could most likely retain those relationships. And that they did that as a self-interested creditor. The trial court heard evidence of that, I believe specifically made that finding in the final order, and that's well justified based on the evidence I've spoken about and a bevy of other evidence as well. I'll address any other questions the court may have.
All right, your time has expired. Rebuttal?
I'll answer two questions. Justice Powell, yes, the client list is an asset. In the underlying trade secret case, that's what it was all about. The defendants broke into Bonair late at night, hacked into the computer system, stole a client list of 6,000 clients, made off, used that client list as a mailing list to their new business. It had been determined that they did that. Mr. Carney was a retired special agent for the FBI. He conducted the investigation. We had a stroke-by-stroke analysis of what happened on those computers, identifying the printing out of 6,000 client names. Mr. Carney also came back and testified. He said, when I went to the auction, the only thing that would have been of interest to me would have been the client list, perhaps the advance bookings. They weren't there. So, yes, those were the most valuable assets. That's what the underlying trial was about. The expert testified it was worth six figures at that time. That was the La Belladonna client list. Regarding the question about backdating.
Your time has expired as well. Call the next case.